Today on the 21st Show, a conversation about foreign policy in this year's presidential election. We'll talk with three Illinois-based experts on Eastern Europe about what difference a Harris or second Trump administration would make for America's role in the world and our safety at home.
I mean, you've got to recognize that the world is a series of very complex moving parts.
On Russian state media, they were laughing about this, that, how could anybody be stupid enough to fall for that? I can't believe they repeated it.
And I think it's actually an important and a difficult question why America cares about defending Ukraine.
I'm Brian Mackey with audio from a live event I moderated last week, and it's coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And today's program is going to be entirely about foreign policy. We're going to hear from three Illinois-based experts about what's been happening in Europe, specifically with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Today's show was recorded before a live audience last week in Champaign, Illinois. It's an excerpt of a two-hour panel discussion and Q&A I moderated, part of a series of events the organizers are calling Undebates, deep dives into policy areas with an emphasis on how it relates to American politics in the upcoming election. It was organized by the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, our partner station NPR Illinois, WUIS in Springfield, and Columbia College, Chicago. The next Undebate is scheduled for Tuesday, September 17th in Springfield on reproductive health care. And the final session is October 3rd in Chicago on immigration. But as we approach the 2024 American presidential election, it's worth remembering that one of the most important things a president deals with, and the area where she or he has the most control, is foreign policy. There are pressing conflicts across the globe. In Sudan, an estimated 150,000 people have been killed, and 10 million have been forced to flee their homes. In Taiwan, leaders are studying other conflict zones in preparation for a fight that mainland China has promised will come someday. Today, however, we're going to focus on Eastern Europe. The live event, I should say, also touched on conflict in the Middle East, where Israel, Gaza, and the Palestinian situation remain critical, but that would be an entirely separate episode. In fact, send me an email if you want us to make that into a future episode. The address is talk@21stshow.org. Joining me for this event was Richard Farkas, a professor of political science at DePaul University. He specializes in the politics of Russia in Eastern Europe, as well as revolution and terrorism, and he's been teaching at DePaul for more than 50 years. Also with me, Nicholas Grossman, a teaching assistant professor of political science at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's a frequent commentator on issues. You can read his writing on The Bulwark and the news site Arc Digital. He's also the author of the book Drones and Terror, Asymmetric Warfare and the Threat to Global Security. And finally, Konstantin Tsionin is the John Dewey Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. Konstantin was born and educated in Moscow, where he was on the faculty of the New Economic School and HSE University. He's been a professor at the University of Chicago since 2015. And in fact, he has a more personal stake in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine than anyone else on the panel. That's because earlier this year, the Russian government put him on trial in absentia, convicted him, and sentenced him to 8.5 years in prison. I began by asking him to talk about that.
When the war started, the Russian government passed a law that basically criminalized everything that is different from the official position of the Ministry of Defense. So I just reposted some information, which was basically from New York Times on the massacre in Bucha. And since the Ministry of Defense official position that this was staged by British intelligence, then obviously this is a crime, and it was a very easy case for the investigators. They just scanned three of my Facebook Telegram posts and demonstrated. Experts said that this is different from the Ministry of Defense position, and here I am, a convicted felon.
A convicted felon. So you can't, obviously you can't travel back to Russia.
You know, about like my friends who vote Democrats at the Higher School of Public Policy, they have this thing about convicted felons nowadays. But what is convicted felon? Everybody could be a convicted felon. Basically, yeah. The main restriction is that I cannot travel not only to Russia, I cannot travel to countries with a fair risk that they would extradite me.
Is this a common situation for people such as yourself who were in, you know, had much of your career and your life in Moscow? You've come to America now. You want to comment on what's happening?
Okay. Dozens of people that I know, and maybe in low hundreds of people, were similarly tried. Some of them are in jail, those who were in Russia. Those who are outside of Russia, they were tried in absentia.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that story with us, and I'm sorry you've experienced that. Dick, I want to turn to you now, and maybe we can go back in time a little and start with the roots of the American relationship with Ukraine, at least since 1991. How did this special relationship develop?
Well, as you all know, that the Soviet Union broke up in 91. 15 separate countries were created. And Ukraine became one of the most significant, one of the three major new countries that were created in the early Yeltsin administration. Ukraine had always been very significant. It was substantial. It was one of the major producers of arms for the old Soviet Union. It's a remarkable agricultural environment with some of the richest soil in the world. And it was a place, like many of the other places that were spawned from the old Soviet Union, that inherited classic Soviet-type leadership in the immediate years following independence. And that continued in Ukraine and sustained what I would call the culture of corruption for a very long time. And of course, I think most of you would understand that what transpired eventually was what was called Maidan. It was basically a rebellion against the actual legal election of a pro-Soviet leader for Ukraine. An election that actually, by European standards, met reasonable standards given the circumstances. But the leader was perceived as pro-Soviet. In the eastern part of Ukraine, there were substantial numbers of people who identified with the Russian language and the Russian culture. And the Ukrainian government struggled, the very new government struggled with the proposition of how to homogenize the society in terms of education, language, and a variety of other issues. At that point in time, the election then turned in such a way that there was a substantial number of Ukrainians who found the election illegitimate in spite of the mechanics being reasonable. And there was a massive demonstration that became a rebellion. It was called Maidan, and that's the square where the action took place. American foreign policy at the time was trying very desperately to support Ukraine. At the time, it was the largest single concentration of American diplomats in the world. We were sending huge numbers of advisors of various sorts, agricultural, economic, political, to Kiev. So we were very much involved in what was an unsettled political environment.
So the elections that were allegedly rigged were in 2004, and there was the first Maidan. In 10 years, when there was the second Maidan and these events, then the guy who lost the 2004 elections was already an elected president for 4 years. So it was basically a mass protest against the sitting incumbent President Yanukovych. Ukraine is a special polity that has an extremely strong democracy, basically in every elections, but one in 30 years, they kick out the incumbent. So in Ukraine, incumbents typically lose. In 5 elections out of 6, the incumbents lose. Then 2000, 2014, these protests, violence, President Yanukovych, the duly elected in 2010 without protests, leaves for Moscow. Then Putin occupies Crimea. Then there is a separatist uprising, but the Ukrainian army in this period of disarray is able to quell the uprising in the eastern Ukraine. Then Russia adds regular troops in August 2014, and the Russian regular troops in Ukraine, they defeat Ukrainian army. So a part of eastern Ukraine becomes occupied by Russian forces. Next year, Petro Poroshenko, the oligarch, is elected president.
Okay, let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to a panel discussion I moderated last week about foreign policy and how it relates to the American presidential scene and the upcoming election. My guests for this were Konstantin Sonin, who is a professor at the University of Chicago. As you can hear there, he was born, raised, educated, and taught in Moscow for many years. Before that, we heard from Dick Farkas, who is a longtime professor of political science at DePaul University, also in Chicago. And in a moment, we'll also hear from Nick Grossman, a professor of political science at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign.
Konstantin, your University of Chicago colleague, John Mearsheimer, gave a speech in 2022, and he's long argued that, and I'm just going to read from it here, the United States is principally responsible for causing the Ukraine crisis. And he says that is not to deny Putin started the war and that he's responsible for Russia's conduct of the war. But he says his central claim is that the United States has pushed forward policies toward Ukraine that Putin and other Russian leaders see as an existential threat, a point they've made repeatedly for many years. Specifically, and this is Mearsheimer, I'm talking about America's obsession with bringing Ukraine into NATO and making it a Western bulwark on Russia's border. What do you think of that? Do you think
for a moment, could I be not a professor of the University of Chicago, but just a European person? I mean, that's funny. Americans that could think that, like, we have conflicts for 1,000 years. Countries occupy each other. Each other country is a part of the neighboring country empire. And then it appears that Americans somehow steer this conflict. I think that America's power is extremely limited. It might be killing of a leader in Vietnam. It might be taking over Nicaragua. It might be something in Haiti. There might be some influence in Europe, support that leader, support this leader, but it's never first order. Ukraine is a huge country. Russia is a huge country. There is an eternal conflict that America is not a player.
Yeah, if I could add to that one, I think it's just a exceptionally bad argument, and in part because, and I think you touched on this, but it eliminates Ukrainian agency. It just assumes that the Ukrainians are not people who make their own decisions, are, you know, that no one could have possibly on their own decided, oh, I don't really want to live under Putin's thumb. I would rather, for example, be more friendly to the EU. And among the reasons that got Putin upset about Ukraine was that they were tilting more in the direction of the European Union and were leaning towards more leaders. And Yanukovych was one who was tilting towards Russia, but with a lot of the population moving there, and I'm meaning a lot of population tilting more in the direction of wanting government towards Europe. And so the Americans of all people should understand the idea of not wanting to live under a foreign dictator's thumb, of wanting, you know, give me liberty or give me death or anything along those lines. And so that part's already odd. And what's doubly odd coming from Mearsheimer specifically is that the theory of international relations that made him famous, the one it's called offensive realism, and he argues in it that countries are, especially great powers, the most powerful countries in the world, are always trying to gain advantages on each other. They will take any advantage they can get. This is just natural. They're all power-seeking, all power-hungry against each other. In other words, Mearsheimer's theory says that Russia would have always tried to reconsolidate its power after the fall of the Soviet Union.
Actually, he said this back in the 90s. He argued that when Ukraine was agreeing to transfer its nuclear weapons to Russia, that this is, Mearsheimer was getting attention because this was a bad move because Russia will attack Ukraine.
Right. So he was always talking about, you know, Russia in that context. And so not only is he going against the idea that the Ukrainians are people who make decisions and have agency, he's also going against his own theory. And I'm not exactly sure why. I, you know, wouldn't want to presume, say, what his worldview is. I just noticed that also. That he made a point of being a guest on state television for Viktor Orban of Hungary, which is the sort of thing that a lot of people could tell you that, you know, going into it, and he probably or should have known this at least, will get used for government propaganda. And he sort of complained a bit about it afterwards, but that suggests a sympathetic worldview.
If I could just add, I've participated on projects and panels with John for more than 30 years. And there was a time when he was an eminent analyst of important things in international relations. But in his later years, he's become very tangential to mainstream arguments. That's the kindest way I can put it. And let me just comment about Viktor Orban. Last night you heard President Trump attempting to underline the fact that he is respected by great leaders all across the globe. And the only name he could come up with was Viktor Orban. I would like you to know that in the 1990s, Viktor Orban took a class from me in Budapest. He was a crazy liberal student, created the Fidesz Party. You had to be under 30 years old to be in the party. And he has himself become transformed into a populist that isn't respected anywhere across the face of Europe, from what I can tell, and is creating quite an embarrassment for himself. What's the point in all of this? I would say that as a serious audience trying to find out about foreign policy, be very careful about the people who call themselves experts.
All right, we are going to take a break. Our show today is about Eastern Europe and how the situation there relates to the American political scene, specifically the upcoming presidential election. This is from a panel discussion I moderated last week in Champaign, Illinois. Because of that, we're not taking calls live, but you can always let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. talk@21stshow.org. More to come after a break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my conversation recorded last week about Eastern Europe, specifically Russia and Ukraine, and how it relates to the upcoming American presidential election. My guests for this conversation, which was part of a program called An Undebate, sponsored by the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, also NPR Illinois, our partner station in Springfield, and Columbia College Chicago. My guests for this were Konstantin Sonin, a professor at the University of Chicago, Dick Farkas from DePaul University, and Nicholas Grossman, professor at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Before the break, we were talking about the arguments put forward by John Mearsheimer that have gained traction, particularly on the American right, about Ukraine and how it's that conflict is largely, in Mearsheimer's view, America's fault, that Russia was provoked into needing to protect this country, protect itself from this country on its border, allying with NATO. None of the panelists put much stock in that argument, and Konstantin Sonin wanted to pick up where we left off before the break.
Let me say one thing. To say what is brilliant in the John Mearsheimer argument, I also was in panels with him, and it's amazing how he connects to audience. And basically, the main thing of his argument is that he talks to American audience and says, you matter, Americans matter. This is like all these things happening around the globe is because of us, because of those who are in White House, because of those who are candidates. And I think it's actually an important and a difficult question why America cares about defending Ukraine. And I could briefly answer
Please.
Why I think.
Yeah.
I think that basically Why America cares about Europe and Ukraine is a result of the traumatic experience of the World War II, that 400,000 Americans died liberating Europe from Nazis. And the idea was that without Americans' involvement, the Europe will again create another bloodbath. So the creation of NATO was consciously, we bear a cost. There is a huge associated cost with NATO, but if we would not do this, they would have another conflict. We will again have to wait for 2 years and then spend a lot of blood and a lot of money to clean this mess. So that's basically the reason why NATO was created. And NATO, like nowadays, some people think that NATO was basically defending against the Soviet Union. NATO had two goals. One is that otherwise, if there is no NATO, then Germany would have its own army. It would very fast develop its machinery. And for the third time in one century, will attack its neighbors. Then defending from the Soviet Union. So NATO, and when people say withdraw from NATO, they consider the scenario that Russia just goes through Poland, Hungary, what's next, Austria, Switzerland, and to Paris. But actually, if Germany is left alone to creating its own war capacity, then this is another major risk. So I think this is why we, in the context of American foreign policy, debate why America needs NATO.
No, and the reason I bring up Mearsheimer is not to validate him. I'm curious. He does have an audience. He does command audiences. We get calls on the show of people saying you should have him on. He's been on the PBS NewsHour. But there is this increasing strain in American thought. Former House Speaker, the Republican former House Speaker and vice presidential nominee, Paul Ryan, said, what I very much worry about is they, and I think he was talking about the Russian government in that case, they're helping curate a line of thought, a school of thought that is isolationist, pro-Putin, pro-Russia, pro-tyranny. At the end of the day, we have one of our major presidential party candidates, and that's one of the reasons we're here today, is to talk about how their policies might affect us, who is not a fan of NATO. So I wonder what you think of that, you know, that strain that we've been seeing develop, especially on the American right.
I think basically the main problem is that 400,000 Americans who were killed liberating Europe, this, like, their memory fades away. So now people, like, we're spending money every year on NATO. Why we should do this? The answer is that you do not want Russia to attack all the neighboring countries. You do not want Germany to develop its own war capacity. That's why American taxpayers pay this money.
So there's a combination of, a lot of it is organically American in the sense that I always get very wary at, you know, the idea that, say, I don't know, the Russian government is mind control and they're controlling all the social media and, you know, tricking people into thinking a lot of things. But so a lot of it is organically American, and you can trace changing attitudes in the United States towards Russia, specifically to the Trump presidency. So for example, this was an Economist YouGov poll did in a couple different polls in 2016, and this was a net approval among Americans of Vladimir Putin, and you can see that the Democrats are extremely negative, and the Republicans start out the year at about minus 40, and after Trump wins the nomination, that jumps up to about minus 20, and then after he wins the election, it's up to about even. About opinions of Vladimir Putin among Republicans. And throughout a lot of the Trump presidency, because Russia had tried to help him in the election win in 2016, including committing a variety of crimes in the United States, whether that actually helped, the political scientist in me says we can't ever really know. You know, whether it put him over the top or not. But because they did, and because the US intelligence community and law enforcement community was trying to counter and prosecute this, he lied about it a lot, and a lot of his supporters lied about it. And this led to, among other things, an impeachment. Now, this was over the first impeachment over trying to extort Zelensky in Ukraine into manufacturing dirt on Joe Biden by withholding weapons. And among the things that happened was a Republican member of Congress who, on the floor, said, no, the 2016 intelligence attack was, actually it was Ukraine that did the interference, not Russia. And Fiona Hill was one of the premier National Security Council experts on Eastern Europe and was serving in Trump's National Security Council, said under oath on the floor of Congress. You know, it's like, I'm sorry, Mr. Congressman, that's made up by Russian intelligence. That is just false. And he sort of persisted with it. And so a decent amount of what's carrying it forward is partisanship, is the idea that if the Democrats are anti-Russia, well, then to be a Republican, you got to be pro-Russia. And if Trump is friendlier towards Russia, well, then if you want to be a good Republican, you should be friendlier towards Russia, too. And Russia works to encourage this. So we just saw a indictment of this detailed indictment come out that about a about a fake media company that Russian intelligence had set up that had distributed about $10 million to a variety of right-wing influencers, YouTubers. Think this was Tim Pool and Benny Johnson and Dave Rubin were among three among them. All of them have over a million followers on YouTube. And it wasn't so much that Russia was telling them what to say. It was that they were already kind of saying it. They were aping a lot of Russian government arguments, including that Russia was a poor, innocent victim in this war, and it's all Ukraine and America's fault, and that what they really want is peace, except they define peace as give Putin what he wants and tell the Ukrainians to surrender. And they were doing this already. But they also got some encouragement. So for example, with the recent ISIS attack this year, there was an ISIS attack in Moscow at a concert hall, and this fake company, Tenet Media, sent word to one of the Americans it was paying off, Benny Johnson, of, hey, you know, it would be pretty good if somebody could you know, blame this on Ukraine and the United States. And then he did. And would he have done it anyway? I don't really know. But so you get both Russian government promotion and partisanship that has made the Republican Party go from the Ronald Reagan Party of very critical about Russia to the Trump Party of very sympathetic and more willing to take Russia's side in arguments against the United States.
Dick, I see you without a microphone. I don't want you to get
left out. If all those threads, and I tend to agree with my colleague, if all those threads don't confuse you, you're a whole lot brighter than I am. The bottom line is, I was wondering about how this could be made to have some sense. And I thought that it might be useful for us to take a momentary look at what would happen if a rational Putin were voting in the election here. And I don't for a moment want to suggest to you that I think he's rational. I think since 2018 in his last election, he's anything but. But let me share with you what he might see or what he might be told by his advisors if he were trying to sort out how to vote. On the Trump side, he would recognize, I think, that Trump would be more open to a new relationship with Russia of some sort or other, that Trump would be less predictable, that Trump would be less concerned by the value differences between our two societies, and that Trump would be more comfortable with a highly centralized leadership, both here and there. Okay, on the Harris side, what would he be thinking about? Well, he would think that Harris would be more cautious about the relationship, that there'd be less likely she'd be less likely to be pragmatic and rationalize, especially in an economic or business sense, that it made sense to reconnect. She'd be less likely to rationalize a rebonding or what used to be called the reset in the relationship. She'd be more responsive to our allies' cautions about Russia. And finally, she'd be more predictable. That's incidentally a calculation by Reuters and their experts. So what is my prediction? Well, I haven't got a clue, to tell you the truth. Our intelligence people consistently across the board tell us that Putin, in fact, favors Trump in the election, but Putin's own advisors are saying explicitly that they prefer Harris. So you'll have to sort out, just like we are, to figure out what in fact is their position.
Let me just take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're listening back to a live event, a panel discussion and Q&A I moderated last week in Champaign. My guests for this were Dick Farkas of DePaul University, we just heard there, Konstantin Sonin from the University of Chicago, and Nick Grossman from the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign.
So just with a briefly on the Putin saying he supports Harris, that on Russian state media, they were laughing about this, that like, how could anybody be stupid enough to fall for that? I can't believe they repeated it. And not that I, you know, want to say, well, you should always believe what Russian state media says, but just thought that was, you know, noteworthy. And I'll be, you know, more blunt about this, of where I think this is the most consequential foreign policy election that we've had in ages, and that in large part because there is a differing vision on, in particular, NATO and the NATO alliance, that Harris has been, throughout her, say, speech at the convention, a strongly pro-NATO candidate, and who has said that it's important for the U.S. to honor its commitments to NATO, whereas Trump has been an anti-NATO candidate, or I guess at best NATO-skeptical candidate, who has said that, among other things, he would let Russia do whatever the hell they want if allies didn't spend enough on defense, which is, you know, more like a protection racket than an alliance, or that in his first term, there were multiple reports of different staffers having to argue with him that, no, you shouldn't pull out of NATO now. A lot of people might get upset about it when you're trying for re-election. Save that for the second term, in which he reportedly said, okay, second term. I don't think it is an exaggeration to say that the American voters are in November, and I don't know what will happen in the election, but I am fairly confident that based on which one is elected, the United States will either end up reiterating its commitment to NATO and by extension Ukraine, or at least pulling back on that and making it where the Europeans are more nervous that they might get attacked, Russia is more tempted that they might be able to get away with an attack on, say, I don't know, Estonia. And if Russia even just menaces a NATO member, and then the United States is not behind them with the Article 5 commitment of an attack on one is an attack on all, then the confidence in NATO and its deterrent effect gets much weaker. And that is, you know, I won't tell people which one they should prefer, but that is what the U.S. is deciding.
I'm sort of less, more skeptical about the ability of if president, would be president, Trump to get out of NATO, because it's complicated, and certainly I do not believe in conspiracy theory about the military-industrial complex, but once or twice in a century, military-industrial complex is on the right side of history, and it's an extremely powerful political lobby, and this is all in support of participation in the joint forces. Also, I frankly think that European countries could withstand an assault of the Russian army in the current state on their own without American help. I think if America withdraws from NATO and Putin attacks Estonia or Latvia, then Sweden and Poland will immediately start fighting, send actual troops. I actually think that's what is sort of disheartening about the current course on Ukraine is that if the Russian army advances towards the large Ukrainian cities significantly compared to what is happening now, and there will be like a real danger of the fall of Kyiv and fall of the Ukrainian government, and then Poland will have to start to fight, the Baltic countries will have to send troops, and then probably United States will have to send American troops. So I actually think that candidate Trump is not thinking ahead enough, but the Democratic administration also doesn't think ahead enough.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. And just as one quick response of where the worry would not so much be if it happens that the Europeans would definitely lose a war, it's that if the security architecture is upended, that there could be a war that would otherwise be deterred.
What Constantine has said is really very important. When you're looking at these issues, they're multi-layered and complex. It's not simple by any stretch of the imagination. And I mention that because it's squarely important about this election. What you have is a candidate who is attempting to share with us the notion that it is incredibly simple. That in fact, if he were in the position of leadership, he could have prevented the war with Hamas, could have prevented the war in Ukraine, and that's patently absurd. I mean, patently absurd. And if there are people in the room who believe that, you got to think a little more deeply. I mean, you've got to recognize that the world is a series of very complex moving parts. And I think anybody who analyzes these things could easily agree with that, save for one of the two candidates.
Okay, we need to take another break. When we come back, we'll hear the conclusion, at least of this excerpt, of a 2-hour panel discussion on foreign policy and how it relates to the American election. This is from a panel discussion I moderated last week. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get to the conclusion, at least for our purposes, of an excerpt of a much longer panel discussion I moderated last week on foreign policy in the American election. This was part of a series of events called Undebates, looking at specific policy areas. It was sponsored by the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois System, NPR Illinois, our partner station, WUIS in Springfield, and Columbia College in Chicago. For the show today, we're focusing on a portion of the conversation that talked about Eastern Europe, specifically Russia and Ukraine. My guests for this were Konstantin Sionin, who was born, raised, educated, and taught in Moscow for many years. Now he's at the University of Chicago. Dick Farkas, who's been at DePaul University in Chicago for 50 years and has also taught in Europe regularly. And Nicholas Grossman, a teaching assistant professor of political science at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's also the author of the book Drones and Terror. Because our show is on tape, we're not taking questions live, but you can always let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org.
I have not had a chance to interview Vice President Harris, but I have talked to a lot of Illinois politicians and U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth. Whenever I ask them about acceptable outcomes from their perspective of the war that Russia has waged against Ukraine, it's what the Ukrainian people want. So what do you think is in the realm of possibilities that could bring this conflict to an end, or at least a long-term pause?
Okay, I always have caveats when I speak, because I immigrated from Russia. I'm anti-Putin and I support Ukraine. I spent 2 months this summer in Ukraine teaching, helping my colleagues at the Kyiv School of Economics. So, but I think Ukrainians would eventually accept anything that guarantees that they will not be attacked again in a couple of years. So people are sort of thinking too much about territorial concessions. Territorial concessions is not a problem. The problem is that if the Ukrainian security is not guaranteed, that whatever concessions they make, then they will be just attacked in 3 years or in 5 years. So we recently wrote an opinion piece with Roger Marson, who is a Nobel laureate, one of the founders of the formal game theory, and Timofey Milovanov, who is the president of the Kyiv School of Economics and a former minister of economy of Ukraine, saying that it's extremely important that the United States, the NATO allies, they promise the NATO membership and full protection of Article 5 to Ukraine, conditional that Ukraine concludes peace. So if they do some concessions, if they do major concessions or minor concessions, they know that after that, they're safe in the same way the Baltic countries are safe now, Finland is safe now, Poland is safe now. So answering your question, I think Ukrainian people, they care more of not being bombed and their kids not being bombed. And the problem with the concessions is that any concession increases Putin's power.
What form would that guarantee have to take, though? Would it be NATO membership?
Why not NATO membership? Germany entered NATO being divided into two countries. So that's then allies help Israel, help defend Israel's security without NATO membership, but still it's very clear guarantee of security. The same thing, United States were extremely clear about providing security for South Korea, although South Korea is not is not a NATO member. But I think this is important to give the Ukrainian government ability to conclude a peace treaty which might involve some concessions.
I want to add on to agree with the point about what a guarantee, as in actually guaranteed enough to convince the Ukrainians that this won't just end up in Russia reconsolidating and attacking again. That one thing important to remember is that for a lot of the Ukrainians, 2022 was not the start of the war. 2014 was the start of the war, and then 2022 was a big escalation of it. And so that showed that they tried at the end of 2014. There were Minsk agreements, and Russia didn't really follow those. And you can understand why the Ukrainians would not simply take Putin at his word. And so what would that mean would be guarantees, real guarantees, actually guarantee it. That means United States. And I mean, maybe with the European Union, I think with nuclear powers of Europe all doing it, but it basically means NATO. And it wouldn't necessarily have to be in NATO itself. I can see something like the US relationship with Taiwan, where all the everybody gets the safe faces. Yeah, Taiwan's part of China. And if you attack it, we're going to protect them. And no, we don't have a formal alliance with Taiwan. That officially ended with Richard Nixon and going to China. But, you know, we're also going to guarantee Taiwan security and don't attack it. And that level of commitment would be the only thing that could really get the Ukrainians and a lot of their neighbors to be convinced that Russia won't just attack them again. The problem with that, of course, is that Russia really hates that idea, and that among their reasons for going to war was to try to be able to take over Ukraine's foreign policy, to make it that Ukraine could not form its own international relationships on its own, in particular that they couldn't join NATO, but also that their relationship with the EU would reduce, and that Moscow would run the foreign policy, not Kyiv. And so granted, that has failed, at least to some extent, who knows? I shouldn't jump the gun on that one. Maybe they end up winning, but in terms of how it ends, Russia would have to come to believe that the effort to conquer Ukraine by force is not worth it anymore. And at least so far, they haven't come to that conclusion. And so if there's a negotiated deal, if on one side of the deal is Ukraine is, if not officially in NATO, de facto in NATO with those level of defense security guarantees, then Russia would be quite wary of accepting that deal. And they don't seem to be poised to do it now. In some manner, their calculus would need to change.
Our suggestion that Russia is not asked, basically, when the Ukrainians stabilize front line, then NATO could unilaterally announce these guarantees. Also, I don't know, for those who do not follow foreign politics closely, I mean, guarantees are not just pieces of paper. So in 2014, when Russian regular forces went into Ukraine in secret, then there was a lot of scare that Russia could attack one of the Baltic countries because they are less protected, they're extremely small. Ukraine is a huge country, Baltic countries are small countries. So what was done is that the United States and France and Britain, they sent some troops for 500 here, 500 to another country. So what was the idea? The idea, of course, 500 troops would not do anything. But they guarantee that on the first day of the Russian invasion of Estonia, there will be dozens of dead French soldiers, dozens of dead British soldiers, dozens of dead American soldiers. So after that, like next day, there will be no question that these countries with full force come to defend this small piece of land, because it will not be like an abstract Estonia in Baltic countries, but it will be a place where just 20 American soldiers were killed by Russians. So this is what like a real commitment.
I read it a little bit differently, and I'll be brief, but my colleagues have suggested to you that the outcome will hinge pivotally on the security agreement. And I can't take issue with that, but I think they're overlooking a texture of Ukrainian thinking. Maybe I'm reading the tea leaves. I teach a course that Ukrainians take constantly every year at the moment, sometimes from their bomb shelters. I think that the lines matter, that the borders matter, that the sovereign boundaries matter, to Ukrainian public opinion. And I think there would be a massive resistance if there were intellectual agreements of a security variety with new boundaries. I think the Ukrainians are prepared to fight for the original boundaries. And I think with the casualties building and the infrastructure damage, they become more intent about that goal as opposed to less.
Yeah, I agree with this, actually. It's just that it's horrible to imagine that this war will drag for like another 5 years or something.
Dick, you I read an interview with you in 2015, so the facts may have changed, circumstances may have changed, your views may have changed. But you compared Ukraine's sort of broad decision to ally itself with America and the West to how we as Americans might feel if Canada decided to spurn us in favor of a closer relationship with China. And I wonder how you think about that today, and because we haven't really talked much about what the Russian perspective would be on this security guarantee and whatever resolution.
Yeah, I was trying to offer a hypothesis that could stimulate some thought. My general sense is that we probably don't account adequately for the Russian psychology about the near abroad. The near abroad, those places that used to be part of the Soviet Union that are now independent states, border states from Russia's perspective. And certainly the events of 2008 in Georgia suggest that there's a very operative notion in their head about their right to manage politics in those adjacent places. I think they misread dramatically the situation by putting Ukraine in that same basket, by continuing to think that there was a capacity for them to continue to exercise that kind of influence.
Do you have a thought on how Russia would respond to this security guarantee and whatever outcome might happen?
I'm pretty sure that Russia, at least under Putin's regime, it will never stop trying to conquer Ukraine. There is no like pain that could be imposed on Putin that he stops. So his armies will stop either when the armies are exhausted or when there is something like a government collapse, which might happen. It's not happening, certainly. There are no signs of this. But in Europe, we had this during World War One, when the Russian imperial government collapsed, then the German imperial government collapsed, and interestingly, it collapsed without a single foreign soldiers on German soil. So Germany was, in a sense, winning, in some limited sense, winning the war when the government collapsed. So then this will, the new government after Putin's government might be more open to negotiations.
Let me just add, there are some internal Russian studies, the credibility of which need to be assessed, that suggest that the Russian economy may not be able to support the war for more than 2 to 3 years more.
I'm constantly answering questions from all over the world where the Russian economy is collapsing. Unfortunately, I read daily economic reports. I'm an economist, and I mean, it's not collapsing yet. It's not doing well. It moves in the wrong direction. It's certainly Russian people subsidize this war by taking cuts on their consumption. This is like the main thing, how the war is subsidized, that people just consume less, they live worse than before the war, but it's not nearly nearly collapsing.
I would not use the word collapsing.
Yeah. Just a brief comment, this, both directions, but where you'd said, you know, the Ukrainians want to get all the land, you know, back and will keep fighting and double down every time they're attacked. And you say, you know, and I think this is probably right too, that Putin will never stop and that, you know, he either needs to die or be overthrown or something. And just want to note that everybody has a breaking point, that everybody says that they will never break. Right up until the point at which they do. And I don't know which will break first, but at some point, one of them is going to have some sort of change in their will to continue fighting.
Oh, and Hitler didn't, famously, the German government didn't collapse. Hitler didn't break down. He was issuing orders until the very last moment.
Right, he was defeated.
I'm not saying that they they were defeated, mm-hmm. but you know, for economists, even it's interesting, their financial system has not collapsed. The Germany had low inflation up until the
total military defeat.
Well, I'd call the military defeat also, you know, collapse. So I guess it could be, yeah, capabilities, not just will, but that could have a breaking point of capabilities. And this would be where, so the sanctions against Russia have been disappointing, say, from a Western perspective on trying to either break the Russian economy or greatly hinder the Russian war machine. And Russia needing to reach out to North Korea and Iran for supply shows that their war economy is being stretched beyond its capabilities, you know, beyond its capacity, and they need to get more from outside. And there is just, there is some point, I don't know what it is, but some point at which a country cannot sustain a war effort.
I want to thank our panel and thank all of you for your excellent attention this evening. We've gone over time, but thank you so much. If we could have a round of applause for our panelists.
My guests for the hour were Konstantin Tsionin of the University of Chicago, Richard Farkas of DePaul University, and Nicholas Grossman of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. That's it for us today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.